This is community radio, open source radio for Sonoma County and the world. This is KWTF, and now another presentation of Voices from Behind the Walls with your host, Albert Big Man Howard.
Hello. Welcome to Voices Behind the Wall. And this is your host, Albert Big Man Howard. Back to bring you more of the story of Marshall Eddie Conway, and in his own words from his book, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther, Eddie Marshall Conway and Dominic Stevens. And our readers today will be Marty McReynolds and David Engel. We'll be going into Chapter 7 and possibly beyond. So stay tuned and stick with us while we bring you this dramatic story.
The Maryland Penitentiary occupied two city blocks in the black community of East Baltimore. The city's population was about 750,000 people at that time. The prison housed 1,300 men from all over the state, but the majority of its population was from Baltimore City itself. There was not one day that went by without some act of violence occurring in the prison. This small area must have had the highest crime rate in the city. The internal violence was tolerated and often encouraged by the administration in order to maintain control of the men within the structure's confines. One group would frequently be pitted against another in what amounted to an orgy of violent frustration. The resultant aggression was transferred from guards to other prisoners. This made it twice as hard to organize, since every conflict could remove a number of brothers from the general population area for 15 to 90 days at a time. These brothers would go on lockup mad, and once they were there, they would become even more hostile than before. This sometimes trumped the political education and training that we were giving the men, because it was likely just beginning to have some impact on their behavior. The hostility and violence that they were immediately subjected to put them back on the defensive, even just for reasons of survival. Whether on the street or within the prison environment, combat was the resolution to most problems for these cats. It was the course of action most often taken by the majority of the lockup population and those guarding them. Nevertheless, organizing within the prison was a necessity, and it became something that many brothers wanted to do beyond anything else, so it was done. There were about 40 or 50 brothers who were the actual members of the Black Panther Party chapter in the prison, and they had about 100 supporters. Initially, the lack of discipline from the rank-and-file members would be a barrier to organizing because of both the lack of political consciousness and an organized structure. But we would soon work together to overcome these limitations. The first thing we did was to form collective units in each housing area and assign officers to supervise the training and other activities. We created a set of policies that all members had to adhere to and made political education and physical education mandatory. We then formed a number of action committees to deal with various needs such as communications and information, security, and education. It seemed that in addition to the daily violence occurring within the prison, there was at least one major incident involving the guards every few months. The first one that I witnessed started in the yard, and the reason was unclear. All I remember is that prisoners started to gather in the yard on one end and guards on the other. By the time both groups arrived at the meeting point, the situation was volatile. On the prisoner's side, there were at least 200 men with sticks, pipes, and other assorted weapons of gang warfare. On the other side, there were about 25 to 30 rank-and-file guards with shields and riot sticks. They stood between the prisoners and the only exit out of the yard, barring at least 200 other prisoners who were not involved in the standoff from leaving the site of conflict. Far beyond them was another line of guards. These were mainly the supervisors, lieutenants, and captains, and they were armed with rifles and shotguns. Up until that time, I believe it was against the law to bring deadly weapons into the actual prison yard. They must have recently gotten the law changed, because the older prisoners were just as surprised as the newer ones. Up in the windows overlooking the yard were two riflemen with weapons poised to take the life of anyone who stepped too far out of line. I was taking the whole situation in carefully, because it looked like there was going to be a riot. This was some time before the uprising at Attica. One of the things that made the situation worse was the fact that, for the past 3 weeks or so, there had been a number of warning signs indicating that there would be trouble if the guards did not let up on the repression and abuse that they had wrought on the men. Incident after incident had occurred, and each brought with it more complaints from old and young prisoners alike. This point is important, because as a rule, older prisoners don't involve themselves in general situations. If it did not personally involve them or their close friends, the administration never heard a word from them. Over the past few weeks, this had changed. A wide range of prisoners were suddenly beefing about the conditions and treatment that they were being subjected to. Everyone agreed that the living conditions were getting worse and the officers more abusive. If, in an environment where the term nigger was used regularly by the guards, such a thing was possible. It felt as if many of the guards had conspired to create the conditions that would lead to a riot in order to obtain greater control through a total lockdown and ever-increasing repression. This would mean that all the prisoners were locked in their cell 24 hours a day. This was perhaps a guard's daily fantasy. Nothing to do all day but walk by a cell once an hour. The entire prison would become a lockup unit, and there would be few exceptions regarding movement among the prisoners. Only a select few men would be allowed to move about, and only because they held essential jobs like food handling and cleanup. Other exceptions would be the typists and record keepers who ran the prison for the guards. During a general lockdown, there would be no showers, no exercise walks, very little medical treatment, and very few visits. The prison could remain like this for as little as 1 day to as long as 1 or 2 years, depending on the situation that caused the lockdown. So that day out in the yard, everyone knew that the situation had come to a head. There were going to be some deaths and injuries on both sides. The odds were not in favor of the prisoners, since they lacked the firepower of the guards, and they would surely suffer the consequences for the uprising. However, the prisoners were poised to bring the odds down, and with so much at stake, both sides faced off and stared one another down. A few terse words passed between the two groups, but no physical contact had been made. The faces of the men on both sides reflected their goals. Some wanted to get it over with, and others wanted to stop it. Yet each side knew there was a need to resolve this situation before it was too late. The prisoners demanded a meeting with the warden to discuss the conditions and treatment that they were subjected to, including the increased harassment. The guards, on the other hand, continued to demand that the prisoners clear the yard, which was an unreasonable, if not impossible, demand, since their ranks were blocking the only exit out of the yard. This resulted in an obvious stalemate, because some of the prisoners did not want to leave the yard, and others couldn't, even if they wanted to. The guards could not go back inside, and they weren't going to let us go between them or behind them. The demands and threats continued on both sides, but it was clear that this situation still had time to be resolved without bloodshed. It was at this point that something happened that was totally unexpected by both the guards and the prisoners. One of the black guards pulled off his helmet and crossed over to our side. Just as suddenly, another joined us. Soon there were half a dozen black guards standing among the ranks of the prisoners. They demanded that the warden come hear our grievances. These men told us to be cool, assuring us all that they would stand with us even if it meant putting their jobs on the line, because they wanted to avoid bloodshed on both sides. Then the other guards backed off, because they could not justify attacking us with their own men standing safely within our midst. It was plain to see that we had some purpose behind our demands to speak with the warden, and that we were not just bent on rioting for the hell of it. Finally, the officials agreed that a small group of us could meet with the warden to address the issues that were continuously being raised by the crowd. All of the prisoners were instructed to return to our respective housing areas. From among us, a group was selected to meet with the administration, and the rest of the prisoners filed through a gauntlet of guards back to their cells. A meeting was held with the warden, and he agreed to look into the situation and correct anything that seemed wrong. The conditions in the yard got a little better, and the level of harassment dropped significantly for a while. But gradually, the same abuses started to occur again. 3 months later, it was as if nothing had ever changed. In fact, as time went on, things got even worse. It appeared that the guards were trying to make the point that things don't get better by rebelling. And at the same time, the population was saying, well, the next time, we will just take it all the way. The mood remained ugly and tense.
This is David Engel, reading Chapter 7, After George. August 21, 1971 found me and a number of my comrades on lockup in the segregation unit. During the early part of my imprisonment, lockup was a frequent experience for me. Most of the time I ended up there as a result of my organizing, but it was also a general principle situation. The administration kept me there because they could, and because this would prevent the organizing. The south wing of the penitentiary housed the punishment unit, and it held up to 400 prisoners, locked in their cells for 23 and a half hours every day. We spent the other 30 minutes in the shower or getting exercise. The activities alternated each day. Many of us had radios but kept them hidden during the day shift between 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. We didn't find out about George Jackson's death until that evening when we pulled our radios out. This sad news quickly passed through the entire unit, and soon the only sound heard was the rumble of the low voices of the comrades asking for updates, and the almost inaudible noise caused by suppressing a scream for too long. This was the sound of 300 years of oppression. Like those whistles that are audible only to the animal ear, this sound is only for the keen ears of the oppressed. So the men swallowed their rage, literally choking it back down. But like all angry emotion, it would eventually inhabit many of the prisoners, like an evil spirit bent on possession. I certainly had no illusions about imprisonment. It had always been clear to me that the comrades in prison were the easiest to attack. While I was personally shocked, I was well aware of the fate that would befall anyone who rebelled against a police state. That night, we held an observance for the death of Comrade George, marked by 3 minutes of silence and a discussion of his life and work. We talked about his death, and many of us were concerned about how the loss of such a significant leader would affect the prison movement. I felt that his death signaled the beginning of the end for the movement. Drugs would soon sate the appetite of the rebellious prisoner. Many of the former rebels would themselves become peddlers of the poison, assisting the government in its genocidal plan for a few coins. Like modern-day Judases, they would betray the people over and over again. Looking back, these were extremely hard times and things were looking bad, so the substance abuse helped prisoners to escape that reality, as well as their past realities. We continued our work while on lockup with a variety of activities. There were education classes 3 nights a week and daily physical training. We also supplied basic necessities such as toiletries for men who were in need, and kept a small library of books that floated among prisoners. These activities were all we felt we could safely do under the current conditions. Yet it was still not enough because the drug use seemed to increase, and soon we had to address the issue in our education classes. This resulted in a campaign to help brothers get off the drugs. Initially, the effort was very successful. One by one, the brothers were declaring to the lockup population that they were no longer using or seeking drugs. Living in lockup was like living in an open community, so it was easy to determine if someone was in fact still using. Everyone knew everyone else's business, and enough men were involved in the campaign to provide a wide network of support and ensure that those men who were using had a non-user nearby. Just when we thought everything was going well, things took a tragic turn. A brother hung himself, and the next day another brother did the same. Both of them had given up drugs. It was then that we made a decision to suspend the campaign, but it would be too late for yet another brother. This death touched my soul. It shook me at the very core, and I must admit it even scared me because it was such a shock. A few days after we suspended the campaign, a brother who was housed 2 cells down the tier from me asked if he could borrow my little red book. After our nightly political discussions, the comrades would often research topics, and so this brother said he wanted to look up something that we had covered in the last class. At the time, we were all out of our cells for exercise, a 30-minute walk on the tier. Lunch was served soon after we were locked back into our cells, and I received my meal with the same lack of enthusiasm that I would always feel toward prison food. The prisoners who were passing the food out moved on to the next cell and then on to the next, when they abruptly dropped everything and ran to the end of the tier to summon a guard. I watched as the guard rushed to the cell while calling for help, but it was too late. The same brother who had only moments ago been contemplating last night's political education class had hung himself. I was dumbstruck because he had seemed as if everything was normal. Later, when I looked at that little red book, I found myself asking if I might have missed something when we talked. Had there been a clue, or the least little inkling, that he was suicidal? At that point, I decided that we would never take away anyone's crutch without first filling that void with something to sustain the individual. While education is good, in no way does it mask the pain that the drugs have been covering up. If anything, the education was opening many of these men's eyes to the suffering that black people had experienced, and this, coupled with imprisonment, was equivalent to opening a vein. It was not long after I arrived at the penitentiary that I began smoking, a habit that I would struggle with for many years to come. One day I was summoned by a group of brothers who had taken members of the prison laundry staff as hostages. These men said they were tired of being exploited. They were barely able to purchase cigarettes with the money that they were making in the prison laundry, and the price had recently gone up. In protest, they staged a non-violent takeover of the wing where the laundry was, and I was called on to negotiate with the guards. I needed a smoke. The urge was new but real. It became a habit that would plague me because I had never experienced a dependence on any substance, and I would always feel that my smoking was a weakness. There was a lot of organizing going on across the nation in almost every community. Prisons around the country were organizing themselves based on the strong trends coming out of California and New York. The men at Attica had just made their grievances known to the public via outside networks. Massive organizing was going on there, and at most of California's prisons. In New York, organizers were working to get as many people involved in the movement for human rights as possible. Their slogan was, "We are men, not animals," while on the other coast, the type of organizing was very selective and often connected to a specific political ideology, as in the case of the Black Guerrilla Family, a group that originally shared ties to the Black Panther Party through Comrade George. The situation for many comrades in the California penal system was one of sheer survival. Since we had much in common with the comrades in California and New York, we decided to do both types of organizing. There would be some selective organizing to develop a cadre, and some mass organizing around general prison issues to get more people involved. Thus, we decided upon a vehicle that would allow us room to do both. We would form the United Prisoners Labor Union. Upon doing some research, we found that the law permitted us to form a union since technically we worked for the state in a collective manner. We began the basic tasks that needed completion before we could officially become a union. First, it was necessary to write up a charter and some bylaws covering the full range of union benefits and responsibilities. Next, we had to sign up 1/3 of the workforce, i.e. population, which totaled about 500 prisoners. Then we had to find an outside union that would accept us. SEIU 1199E had begun to work with us, so they agreed to accept us. We were also required to form an outside advisory board to coordinate between us, the prison administration, and the parent organization. And finally, we had to hold an open election in the workplace to make sure that there were enough prisoners desiring a union. So many of us spent weeks reading and studying other unions' bylaws and agreements, and after what seemed like too many meetings, we produced a finished copy of our union charter and bylaws. While this had been going on, some members had been assigned to do outreach. This included working the yard and talking to the general population about the need for a union, as well as describing the process that was necessary to establish one. They also had to sign up as many people as possible so that we would meet the required numbers. This job was done by all of us at some point in the process. It was perhaps the hardest part of the whole program because the administration was pushing a counter-union movement. This agenda was being carried out by members of one of the new youth gangs that had formed within the prison population and was beginning to grow fast. The New Family, as it was called, claimed to be not only the new wave in the prison population, but also the future gangsters of Baltimore. This group was led by a small clique of tough guys and fuckboys, members of the prison bisexual culture, who not only worked with the administration, but also had the ear of the youth population, especially newly arrived youth looking for a protection hookup. This group had no politics to speak of, but the leaders viewed themselves as godfathers, helping the government against communist elements that were misleading the population. This group was working day and night to oppose the union and our organizing efforts. They kept telling the population that this was a communist thing and un-American. They were capitalists and therefore believed in free enterprise, which they were willing to work for even if it meant working for the administration. Many was the time that one of our organizers would be working with a group of prisoners, explaining the charter, going over the different points and answering questions they might have. When along would come one or two new family members to disrupt things. They would attempt to distract everyone by sparking a debate on any number of issues. Where was the money coming from to pay minimum wages, and who was going to pay the union officials, they would ask, and then suggest that this effort would simply get the state mad at us, and result in the authorities pulling all the workshops out of the penitentiary and giving them to another prison in the state without a union, so on and so on. At other times, our organizers would find themselves confronted by guards who would query them about what they were doing or ask more threatening questions about what they had in their pockets. This would almost always lead to a search or shakedown, and in some cases, heated words would be exchanged and our organizer would end up on lockup with a bum rap. Yet in spite of all the efforts to stop the union organizing, we signed up over 500 men with a lot of serious work by many brothers in the yard. At the same time that we were enjoying the success, two other things were occurring. One was the union's executive board accepting us officially and involving itself in giving support by contacting the prison officials on our behalf. This particular union was a good choice to work with because of its history. It had been engaged in a struggle to organize the hospital workers in Baltimore, and the fact that this had been an ongoing battle for 2 years made it a real tough job. We knew that unionizing the prison would also prove difficult. 1199E also happened to be the union that Dr. Martin Luther King had been working with before his assassination in Memphis, Tennessee. They were organizing the sanitation workers. And finally, this union had positive leadership and a good organizer in Fred Punch, who was the president at the time. He was bold and outspoken when it came to expressing the concerns and interests of the people he was working with. We needed that kind of positive and progressive support and thought that we could get it from 1199E. Once we had made contact with them and developed a common platform that we could work with collectively, we were able to garner enough support from the population to win the vote. Another group had simultaneously been working to develop an outside advisory board. We contacted a number of community leaders and explained what we were trying to do to better our conditions at the penitentiary, and a number of them agreed to act as members of an advisory board, including radio personality Kitty Brody, Perrin Mitchell, who would later become a Maryland congressman, Paul Coates, a comrade from the Black Panther Party and owner of the Black Classic Press, and others. This ad hoc advisory board contacted the officials at the penitentiary and arranged meetings between all of the parties. The organizing that was happening in the prison yard was going so well, we decided to downgrade the amount of union activities there and redirect our attention toward the development of committees that would carry out the union programs and policies once we won acceptance. As I look back, these were wild and foolish days because even though we expected to be attacked, we did not expect the lengths to which the administration would go to put an end to the organizing. Since we were working within legal boundaries, we figured that any attack on us would clearly be seen as an attack. It never occurred to us that they would frame us to make it stick. We were doing serious organizing and doing it above ground and legally. The level of success was surprising even to us. We had no idea that the vast majority of prisoners wanted something like this so badly that they were ready to meet any crisis or work around any problems. The general population worked hard at building a union despite the interference of the youth gangs. The prisoners who held jobs and positions that couldn't be linked to the union organizing efforts for fear of retaliation from the administration willingly did everything that we needed done secretly. The support of these men was extremely important to the development of the union. Some of the work they did was more serious than the work that some of the members did, because they supplied information about the prison's finances, specifically the fact that prisoners were receiving what amounted to pennies while they produced millions in profit for the prison industry. For every two people who signed up, there was at least one other prisoner who actively supported the union without joining. We had a wide range of members and supporters from the very old to the very youngest prisoners who were developing a consciousness and awareness of the need for change. The whole population was full of positive energy and in high spirits because there was real hope for change at last. Even many of the prisoners who we had labeled as Toms openly broke with the administration over the issue of the union. Needless to say, while all this was going on, the administration was planning their counterattack to disrupt our organizing efforts and union activities. Minor incidents began to occur, and it looked as if they would soon grow into a major situation. We found ourselves acting as union marshals, or more precisely, peacekeepers, so that the general population would not be tricked into engaging in negative activities that might be blamed on the union organizing efforts, or that might affect the official establishment of the union. Most of the troubleshooting was done on the spot between individual prisoners and guards who had some sort of personal beef. It became very clear right from the start that the guards were turning up the pressure on the entire population, and the incidents were not at all at random. The selection of specific prisoners for harassment made it clear that this was an organized effort by the guards. The prisoners stopped and searched most frequently were those who were all too likely to become violent. This harassment was continual during this period. The very fact that imprisonment involves so many rules that it is difficult not to be in violation of some rule at any given time lent itself to this harassment. The guards rarely enforce the very petty rules and regulations like those that define limits on what a prisoner can have in his cell at any given time, such as 5 pens or pencils or 20 stamps. There are other vague rules concerning how a prisoner looks at a guard, be it lustful or hostile. This is called reckless eyeballing, and the interpretation of your gaze is left to the individual guard. To raise one's voice during the disagreement with a guard could result in a charge. The very space in which a prisoner plants his feet might place him in violation of a rule. One guard could see the prisoner's feet as 6 inches over a yellow line and determine that he was out of bounds. Another guard might consider it an escape attempt. Yet another may simply tell the prisoner to move on. Because the enforcement of these rules is at the whim of the individual guard, things can go south quickly if the parties involved have a hostile relationship, or if the administration wants to turn up the heat on the population. We had to keep talking to the prisoners subject to the most harassment, and while most of them really supported the union, their tempers tended to get out of hand sometimes. The fact that they supported the union and could see the administration was looking for a major incident to derail the union made these brothers hang in there and sometimes even accept the harassment with a smile. The prison officials soon realized that there was so much support for the union that the population was policing itself. Any man starting trouble would get pulled up by another prisoner and stopped, or taken away and isolated, depending on the nature of his response to the other prisoners. Most prisoners would realize what was happening once someone stopped them for a second and pointed it out. They would smile and walk away from the situation on their own, and because of this self-control and discipline in the general population, we thought we had the situation under control. We were wrong about that. Within a few days of the failed harassment attempts, the key leaders of the union were placed on lockup one night in a midnight raid on the housing areas. At the next level of attack, we found ourselves charged with illegal organizing of an unauthorized organization. All 39 of the union's leaders were removed from the general population, leaving the committee chairman with over 500 angry and leaderless members. We had agreed beforehand to counsel calmness and control if something like a mass arrest took place. That night, before leaving the housing units, we reinforced this concept with all the secondary leadership we could find. We told them to make sure that everyone was cool and not to allow this massive lockup to distract them from the real issue, the need for the union. It was our belief that once we succeeded in our task, this type of repressive behavior on the part of the officials would no longer be easy to carry out. Placed on lockup yet again, I waited along with everyone else to see what the morrow would bring. Collectively, we discussed our hope that the chairman would be able to control the situation. I had a cell in front of one of the windows that allowed me to see out into the yard. I watched the prisoners file out in the yard to go to breakfast and then on to work. I knew then that response would slowly develop throughout the day among the population, since they had talked from cell to cell in the hours after we were locked up. They were milling around and asking questions about what should really be done now. I could see some of the more hot-headed members and a few outsiders demanding that something happen to show the administration that they could not keep doing this to us. The political education classes paid off here because comrades managed the situation beautifully, gaining control so that there was not a single incident. Over the next few days, the outside executive support worked on meeting with the Commissioner of Corrections and the prison administration about the mass lockup of our leadership. At this point, the administration moved into phase two of its attack on us. In the middle of the night, we were all sitting at our doors on lockup, proudly talking about the future of the union and how the population was standing firm. Word came in from one of the runners that there was an incident going down in the West Wing. A number of prisoners had climbed up into the windows. The upper-level windows were at least 75 feet high, and the flats were made of concrete, so if someone fell from that height, it was likely to be serious, if not fatal. Those of us on lockup had no idea about what caused the incident or who was involved in it, but the situation remained at a stalemate for several hours. Apparently, it had all started around 9 or 10 p.m. that evening, and it was not until 2 or 3 a.m. when the men came down from the windows. The guards started bringing the men over to lockup, and this was the first chance we got to see who they were. Right from the beginning, it looked all wrong. The majority of these men were known drug addicts, and the others were most likely users as well. Why in the world would drug addicts be doing something as rebellious as refusing to lock in and going up in the windows when they had never before been involved in any protest or any other proactive activities? And on top of that, most of these drug addicts were known to be informers for the administration. The fact that there was not one union member or progressive individual among them let us know right away that this was another effort to undermine our union building. The next day, the entire institution was locked down, and the window incident was blamed on the union organizers. The prison administration held a press conference during which they claimed that the union was responsible for this rebellious act, that it was a reaction to the mass arrest of the illegal organizers. In essence, they said we were simply bad elements in the prison trying to stir up trouble. To add insult to injury, they also went so far as to claim that the advisory board members had been misled by us and that they didn't realize what they were doing by encouraging us in this destructive behavior. They would have to be protected from us since they did not understand the mentality of prisoners. The prison administration informed advisory board members that they could no longer meet with us. In addition, the members were prohibited from doing any union organizing within the Department of Corrections or the penitentiary. The next day, the entire union leadership received 60 to 90 days on lockup for organizing the union. The prison itself remained locked down for another week to let the general population know that more would be coming if the union kept growing. Some people received transfers to other institutions as disciplinary measures. The resulting news story referred to the situation as the human fly incident and completely eclipsed the truth. The papers carried the story from the administration's viewpoint. They made the union look like a gang of troublemakers and our community supporters seem like uninformed liberals who had unknowingly encouraged this behavior. The union backed out of their commitment to us, and with our outside supporters barred from the institution and the internal leadership of the union locked up, the union drive in the penitentiary just died. When the prison opened back up a week later, all union activities were banned, and all union and lecture materials were declared illegal by the officials, who gave orders to arrest anyone caught with them. The administration had used the human flies to kill off the union, but the flies would be back soon enough to haunt the administration.
Hi, I'm Marty McReynolds. We're reading from Martial Law, Chapter 8, Fly on the Wall. Several weeks later, while we were still on lockup, a lone prisoner was demanding medical treatment for some problem he had. It was 4 days before the guards decided to take him to the hospital, and once there, he never even got to see the doctor. The doctor, he was told, was on call, but he would only be summoned for emergencies, and normal medical problems would have to be handled by the nurse. Well, this prisoner only got to see the nurse, and he was not happy when he returned to the lockup area. He requested a talk with the supervisor about his problem, but his request was refused. And so out of the frustration, more than anything else, he broke away from the guards and climbed up into the windows. At first, no one understood what was going on, because the situation was happening on the other side of the lockup, so most guards and prisoners assumed it was some kind of fight. All we could hear were shouts coming from the other side. "That's right! Fuck them punks! Go on with it! And be careful, brother!" It would be a few minutes before the guards who went running around to that side looking for a confrontation became aware that a human fly was back. Soon, as was always the case with such an incident, a mob of officials came to the lockup area to talk to this prisoner. It never failed. If a prisoner needed to talk to a supervisor, they were always too busy. But as soon as the prisoner took some type of action, there were more officials on the scene than one might see in a year. Now, all of a sudden, they all wanted to know what the problem was, and why no one had informed them about this medical situation. Would the brother please come down so they could take care of the situation and get him to the doctor right away? In fact, they said, the doctor was on his way. He was on his way in right at that moment. Well, this brother did not seem to buy it, and it turned out that he had requested to see a supervisor a number of times before, and each time he had gotten the runaround. They had given in and taken him to the hospital finally just to keep him quiet, but it was to no avail. Almost every official in the prison was now standing around on the flats trying to convince the brother that they were all concerned about his medical problems. But he didn't want to talk to them about it anymore. The brother now wanted to talk to the news media. He informed them that he was not coming down until he could talk to the press. Since he was in the windows facing the street outside of the prison, people passing along Forest Street could see and hear him. The official did not want to shoot him out of the window in front of the public, so they were at a loss as to what to do to deal with him. They had brought in mattresses and stun guns to shoot him down, but the people outside were already talking to him. They asked him what his name was, and some folks promised to call the media. The administrators inside the prison could not talk him out of the window, and it was clear that they had no intention of meeting his demands to hold a press conference about the medical treatment of the prisoners. The situation reached a stalemate and then turned into a standoff, with the prison officials withdrawing to plan another course of action. The brother had the run of the South Wing area since he could cross over to the other side by climbing over the back shower area. He traveled from level to level by climbing up and down the grills in front of our cells. This gave him direct access to each prisoner on the lockup section, with the exception of the prisoners on the flats, because it was too risky to go down on the ground level. This amounted to contact with well over 200 prisoners, and together they fed him and gave him warm clothes along with a long list of grievances to give to the press on their behalf. The next day, two more prisoners joined him up in the windows after returning from the visiting room. They climbed up in the windows to great applause, and soon another prisoner who was returning from the adjustment team hearing room, where he had received more time on lockup, joined the others in the window. Later that night, another prisoner had his attempt to join the men thwarted. However, the next day brought a number of tries more from prisoners, and two of these men were successful, though most were stopped by the guards. Nevertheless, the human fly situation was growing too fast for the officials to keep up with it. The news media turned out to cover the happenings, but the prison officials prevented reporters from speaking to the prisoners. The media was honoring an unwritten agreement. They never reported incidents inside the prison unless prison officials okayed it. Despite the administration's best efforts to prevent coverage of the situation, people outside were taking an interest in what was happening inside the prison. They wanted to know what could have caused this kind of behavior. Prisoners told visitors coming into the visiting room about the grievances that were by then the collective demands of the flies, who were now representatives for the entire lockup section. This had moved from an incident involving a single individual to a general protest of the living conditions in the lockup section. The flies had been talking to anyone who would stop and listen on the street below the prison windows. The 900 block of Forest Street was an open area that ran in front of the prison, and it had a good deal of traffic throughout the day and a nominal amount at night. In fact, this street served as a shortcut from downtown Baltimore to the nearby black community. Many people coming from work or shopping trips downtown would pass through this street. Visitors to the prison would also come down this street, as well as employees working in the surrounding administrative complex. Many of these people were stopping to talk to the prisoners in the windows, trying to find out what was going on. Soon, there were people who were coming by just to talk to the prisoners. The officials decided they could not allow the number of flies to increase, so they ordered the guards to handcuff anyone who was out of their cell for any reason. All prisoners now had to be escorted by three guards at all times. This made for an extremely difficult situation, since only four or five guards were normally stationed in the South Wing at any given time. This meant that if someone went on visit, it could be almost 2 hours late because of the lack of manpower. The fly group stopped growing, but visitors began to complain about the amount of time they had to spend waiting for prisoners in the visiting area. The plan was working well for the prisoners on lockup. It's impossible to climb into the windows with handcuffs on. But the officials overlooked something. The whole lockup unit was staffed by prisoners who did all of the labor. They passed out the food and the sheets, cleaned the floors, and packed and moved the property of those prisoners on lockup. They also did paperwork and ordered supplies. All of these prisoners had friends on lockup, or they had been locked up themselves at some point in the past. Those who had worked in the South Wing lockup unit the longest had seen a lot of abuse and mistreatment of prisoners behind the doors. Some of the guards had singled out different prisoners to be harassed and kept in the unit by continuing to give them new charges and new sentences. The prisoners working there would see all this, and sometimes they would carry news and information out to the general population to contact so-and-so's people because he just got beat up by the pigs, or let us know that someone else didn't receive any treatment for this or that ailment. Other times they would join in the protest about this or that problem that the men behind the door might have, and in real serious cases, they would even go to the supervisor about the conditions. There have even been times when the workers have stood up for a prisoner who was out by himself and under the threat of attack by the guards while in handcuffs and unable to defend himself. The workers would stand with him until the guards put him back into the cell. All too often, specific prisoners the guards wanted to beat would be brought out late at night and jumped on and thrown into the hole or isolation unit away from everyone else. It would be days sometimes before anyone saw them or knew if they were okay. They might need treatment for something broken or a deep cut or anything else, but no help was forthcoming to these brothers. And all the workers knew this could be their fate at any time in the future. It was not unusual for prisoners brought from the population to be attacked in the isolation area before being placed in the lockup cell. The workers would know someone was in the hole and being beaten, but they frequently couldn't find out who it was for hours, or sometimes even days. This was also hard on them, and they suppressed a lot of anger against the guards while working in that area. Well, given all of that, it's not surprising that once the prisoners in the cells were stopped from joining the flies in the windows by the handcuff order, the workers started to join. Two of them climbed into the window before the rest were locked up in an area away from the windows. Eventually, seven prisoners were climbing all over the housing unit windows, and the press was camped out in the street with a number of supporters who had also camped outside the windows to see that nothing happened to their friends and family members inside the prison. The Black Panthers, local church groups, and other progressive groups and concerned citizens had actually set up a squatters' camp outside the South Wing, and they were refusing to leave. They vowed to stay there until the situation inside was resolved. The combined support of so many different groups and the daily presence of the local media put real pressure on the prison officials, who finally agreed to resolve the situation. They allowed a press conference, and the human flies were interviewed and presented their list of grievances. Community leaders were called on to ensure the men's safety and to see that they were not attacked later. However, after the press attention dwindled, and some weeks after a few minor changes occurred, the situation slipped right back to the same old abusive and repressive relations between guards and prisoners. For a few short weeks, prisoners had used the same tactics against the administration that they had used to break our union drive. Their own ghosts were now haunting them. The support that we received from grassroots members of the Baltimore community during the union drive and the second human fly incident helped to change the way many prisoners thought about the community outside the prison and its people. Suddenly there was interest in what was going on in the community, and the one thing that stood out was the lack of information prisoners had about the community at large. There were 4 television sets for the whole population of over 1,700 prisoners. A few prisoners ordered the daily newspapers, but most men had to rely on the local radio station for news and information about what was happening outside. In many cases, the news coming from the local black radio stations was no news at all. At best, there was 30 to 60 seconds of junk news that had little or no real relevance to the daily situation and struggle in the black community. The men would find themselves passing around rumors and misinformation in an effort to keep up with what was happening. Several of us decided that we could have an impact on the situation if we had our own newspaper. Since it was impossible for us to simply start producing a newspaper immediately, we settled for a page one newsletter that covered weekly news and events. The Maryland Penitentiary Intercommunal Survival Collective put this newspaper out, working from a cell in our housing area. The issues of the local papers and the underground papers we managed to acquire were perused, and items we thought were of the most interest for the prison population would be extracted from them and encapsulated so that we could get as many news items as possible on that single page. This paper would be mimeographed and sent to each housing area in bundles. This caused problems almost right away, because we could see from reading all the newspapers available to us that there were big differences in the political and social perspective. Also problematic was the fact that some black community newspapers were allowed to come into the prison, while others were classified as too radical or a threat to the security of the institution. An interesting fact in and of itself.
You've been listening to Voices from Behind the Walls with your host, Elbert Big Man Howard, reading with him today, David Engels and Marty McReynolds. This is community radio for Sonoma County and the world. This is open source radio sharing for our community. This is KWTF. For more information on how to support or volunteer your time, go to our website, kwtf.net. Next time, more reading from Marshall Eddie Conway's book, Martial Law, with your host, Elbert Big Man Howard, on Voices from Behind the Walls. This is KWTF.
I'm gonna take myself a piece of sunshine and paint it all over my sky, yeah. Be no rain. Be no rain. I'm gonna take the song from every bird and make them sing it just for me. Something to teach us all about being free, yeah. Be no rain. Be no rain. And I think I'll call it morning from now on. Why should I survive on sadness and tell myself I've got to be alone? Why should I subscribe to this world's madness, knowing that I've got to live on? From now on.
gonna take myself a piece of sunshine and paint it all over my sky, yeah. Be no rain.